Mas eu me interesse maior. E quando você está aqui em França, por dynamic languages. Ok. So let's say I am a data scientist and I am experimenting with some data in CSV. So for instance, here I have a list of cities together with the associated country, population, density, and there may be some extra columns. As I am experimenting with the data, I need a programming language that allows me to easily manipulate the data in a precise way. So for instance, one thing I might want to do is to retrieve the population associated to a given city. We are going to see how to implement that first in Rust, which is a strongly typed static programming language. And then we will implement it in Python, which is a dynamic language. And so we will be able to compare the two. So in Rust, if we want to implement this function getPopulation, it looks like this. So this comes from the documentation of the CSV Reader library. So this is a function that takes two parameters, the CSV data and the city, both are strings. On the first line, we parse the CSV data and put it in a data structure. Then we retrieve the index corresponding to the city column. Then we retrieve the index of the population column. And then we iterate through all the rows until we find one that has the right city. And in this case, we return the corresponding population. And if we don't find any such city, such row with the right city, we return one. So even though the algorithm is quite simple, the code is quite verbose. And there are several reasons for that. So first, one thing we may notice is that the programmer has to annotate the type of the data, of the parameters, data and city, and of the return value. Another thing we might notice is the need for the programmer to wrap the return value. As I said, this function can have two behavior. It can either return the population or return the special value none. But actually, it will not be possible in Rust to directly return an integer or the value none, because they are not of the same type. And Rust forces you to have an homogeneous return type. So what we do instead is that we wrap the integer, the population, into the constructor sum, so that both sum and none are of the same time, same type option. So we might think it is not a big deal, but actually we also have the user direction. When we call a function, and that, for instance, this function may fail, then this function will have its result wrapped in case when it does not fail. And so we have to unwrap it. And it becomes a lot verbose in this case. So now let's compare it to the Python code. The same function in Python, if we look at the documentation, we find this code. So it is a lot more concise. Algorithmically, it is the same idea. We iterate through all the rows and return the pair that matches. So one thing you notice is that we don't have types anymore. And also, we can return in a case the null value, and in another case, we can directly return an integer. So, what this changes when we apply the function, when we call getPopulation in Python, if we know that the city is on the CSV data, we can just assume that it will return an integer and directly do some operation on it. Whereas in Rust, we will have to call nwrap even if we know that the city is present. So we might wonder, no, but how can we handle the error case in Python? So what we could do in Python is what we call a type case. So for instance, here in the function in1000, it takes the parameter n and it dynamically tests whether the type of n at runtime is an integer. We call that the type case. And so if n is an integer, it divided by 1000, otherwise it returns null. So this function in1000 is what we call an overloaded function, because it has several behaviors, and which behavior to choose is the behavior is selected at runtime depending on the type of the parameter. And so for instance, if we call in1000 on something that is an integer, it returns an integer. And if we call it on something that is none, for instance, the population of JPEG, it returns none. Okay, so let's summarize what we have seen. So in the dynamic languages, most of times the programmer does not need to write like annotation. Also, function can accept and return data of different types. We don't need to explicitly wrap them like in Rust. Also, we have overridden function either via explicit type case like we've seen or via a built-in mechanism of dynamic dispatch. Overall, this makes dynamic language good candidates for experimenting on prototyping because this makes the language flexible and concise. But there are also drawbacks. In our Python code, it is not clear where the program can fail. Actually, any sub-expression could write an exception. Whereas in Rust, it was clear at each call to unwrap, we know that it will fail in some case if there is an error. Also, we don't have type safety guarantees, which means that at runtime, when we execute the program, it might raise a type error. So, for instance, if we try to add one to none, which is a non-defined operation. Also, we have no static type. And this may be an issue for the documentation because it's a good thing for the programmer to know what types the function accepts. And this might also be an issue for the tool chain, like the optimizer, the linter, or the autocomplete feature, because those tools also, it's very useful to have types, static types for those tools. And so this makes dynamic language often, they are often unsafe and bad for production code or maintenance of large projects. Okay, so with that in mind, I can state my goal. My goal is to statically type dynamic languages without hindering their flexibility. So I have written the point from the previous slide. And let's see for each one what it implies on the type system. So as the programmer does not need to write type annotation in a dynamic language, this means that my type system should be able to infer the types. As the function can accept and return data of different types, it means that my type system should feature union types and subtyping. In this way, we may say, for instance, that the function getPopulation returns either an integer or the value none. This is a union type. And also, we have overloaded function. And so our type system should be able to type cases and to capture overloaded behavior. And for that, we will use intersection types. Also, my contribution has been to design a type system for a language with type cases that features many forms of polymorphism. We will see that we have parametric polymorphism, other polymorphism, and subtyping polymorphism. And we have a type inferred. So first, I'm going to introduce the types we will use and the core language. And then I'm going to define a declarative type system for this language. This type system will be powerful, but it will not be an algorithm. There will be sources of non-determinism. So the next step will be to define an algorithmic type system that is equivalent to the declarative one, but that is algorithmic. But this algorithmic type system will rely on some external annotation that specify, for instance, the domain of functions. And so naturally, the last step will be to define an algorithm to reconstruct the annotation, define the domain of function, etc. Okay, so let's start with a more concrete example. Let's say I want to type JavaScript logical OR. So this is a double pipe operator. So this is a function that simulates the behavior of the logical OR in JavaScript. So first, it takes two parameters x and y. It converts x to a boolean. If it is true, it returns x. Otherwise, it returns y. So if I want to type this function, first I have to type two boolean. So in JavaScript, two boolean is a function that converts a finite set of value false, null, zero, the empty string to false, and any other value are converted to true. So what I am going to do is to give a name to those values. The values are converted to false, I call them falsy, and the other values, I call them truthy. So we can define those two types using union types, like here. And negation. So this is not JavaScript. JavaScript does not have type, but this is a language that the language of the prototype I made. And now that I have defined these two types, I can give a type to two Boolean. So two Boolean has the type falsy to false and truthy to true. So here, what's interesting is the intersection. It allows us to express the overloaded behavior of the function. When we give it something pretty, it returns false. When we give it something to p, it returns true. Okay, so now we can type the logical or. And the type we would like to infer for it is the following one. So in this type, we have an intersection to capture the overloaded behavior as before, but you also have type variables and quantification. So that is parametric polymorphism. Here, the first branch corresponds to when we give as first argument something that is true p, and in this case, it says that it returns exactly the first parameter. And the second branch is when we give something policy as first parameter, and in this case, it returns exactly the second parameter. If you want to be able to infer this type, we have to overcome several challenges. So first, we have to perform what we call type narrowing or occurrence typing. So the idea is that when we type the first branch, the return x, we have to type it under the hypothesis that x is true phi. Why can we make this hypothesis? Because if x was not true phi, if it was falsy, then it would have taken the second branch. We will implement type narrowing using union types. Also, we have to express overloaded behaviors, as we have seen, and we will use for that intersection types. And lastly, we want to capture genericity, and we do that using parametric polymorphism. Okay. So now let's define the types we will use. So as we have seen, we need intersection, union, polymorphism. So we will use what we call set theoretic types. So in that syntax, we find the constants, also called singleton types. So we have false, true, integers, etc. Then we have some base type like bool, integer, string, etc. And we have the arrow to express for function, the product for pairs, and we can express the union of two types, the intersection of two types, the negation of a type, and we have the special type empty that has no inhabitants, and the special type any that is the type of all values. So now we want to express a subtyping relation for those types. And for that, we will associate each type to a set of values. We say, for instance, that the interpretation of the type false is a singleton that contains the constant false. The interpretation of int is a set of integers. The interpretation of any is a set of all values. And the interpretation of empty is empty interpretation. Then we can define the interpretation of a product, and it will be the product of the interpretation. The interpretation of t1 to t2 will be intuitively the set of function from t1 to t2, even though we don't actually define it like that, but it is the idea. And the interpretation of a union is the union of the interpretation, etc. So now that we have an interpretation for our type, we can define subtyping easily. We say that a type t1 will be a subtype of t2 if and only if the interpretation of t1 is included in the interpretation of t2. So we are missing one last ingredient, as we need polymorphism, parametric polymorphism, we need type variables. So we can add type variables to the syntax of our types. And we just extend the subtyping relation. We say that a type T1 will be a subtype of T2 if and only if, for any substitution sigma, T1 sigma is a subtype of T2 sigma. So in particular, this ensures that subtyping is preserved by instantiation. Okay, now let's define our language. So we will use a callback value lambda calculus, pure lambda calculus. So we have a constant, variable, lambda traction, application. We also have pairs and projection. And we have a construct for type cases. So what is the semantic of type cases? First, we reduce the value we want to test. And if we get a value that is of type T, then it reduces to the first branch. And otherwise, it reduces to the second branch. Okay. So now I have defined my language and my types. So I will try to make a type system for this language. So for that, we will start with some very common views. So we have a view for constant, for variable, for pairs and projection, for lambda abstraction and for application, other common rules. Also, as we have subtyping, we need the subsumption rule that states that if we can derive the type T for E, then we can derive any type T prime that is a subtype of T. So now we are going to add some more rules to those ones in order to increase the expressivity of our system. So what we're going to do is to add rules from different type system. We add rules from Hilde-Miller type system for polymorphism, some rules from intersection type system, and some other rules from union type system. So alone, none of these rules are new, but my contribution has been to combine them in a single type system. Let's start with Prelex polymorphism. So for that, what we do first is to partition our set of type variables. We consider that some type variables are polymorphic and some others are monomorphic. And then we say that at any time when we have a polymorphic type variable, we can instantiate it. So we can substitute it by any type we want. So this is like in the minor type system. And also, we have the rule to generalize type variable. So if at some point we have a type with a monomorphic type variable, we can generalize this type variable and make it polymorphic, but only if this type variable does not appear in our environment, or otherwise it will be unfound. So again, it is like in the minor. So in practice, let's see that with an example. If I want to type this program, so first I define the identity and then I define tests which apply two times the identity. What I can do first is to type the identity, and for that I use the rule for lambda abstraction, and I generalize its type, which is the polymorphic type alpha to alpha. And then I want to type the definition test. And so first I have the first application ID to 42, and to type this one, I can just substitute alpha by 42. And independently from that, I can type the second application ID applied to true. And for that, I substitute alpha by true. And again, I can divide your type a precise type. In the end, I get the type 42 times 2 for this program, for test. Okay. So now we need a fuel to handle intersection. So for that, we need the intersection introduction fuel, which says that if we can derive the type T1 for E, and if we can also derive the type T2, then we can derive the type T1 and T2. So usually in the natural deduction, we also have a rule to eliminate the intersection, to use an intersection that we have as hypothesis. But in our case, we don't need it because we have subsumption, we have subtyping. And so if at some point we can derive the type T1 and T2 for an expression, then by subsumption, we can also derive the type T1. So let's see an example. If I want to type the identity, I have several ways to do that. I can use polymorphism as before, but I can also press and choose to type it for the domain bool, which is the type bool to bool. Then independently, I can type it for the domain int, which is the type int to int. And then I combine those two types, which is the overloaded type bool to bool and int to int. And now the last ingredient, we need a rule to handle union. So the union is in some sense the dual of the intersection. So in the intersection, we didn't need a rule for the elimination. Here we don't need a rule to introduce union, because by subtyping, if we can derive the type T1 for an expression, we can derive the type T1 or T2. But we need a rule for the elimination of union. So this rule basically what it does, so we want to type an expression. What we can do is to select a sub-expression E prime in this expression and to decompose its type into the union S1 or S2. And then we consider each case separately. We type this expression by assuming that it, this prime has the type S1, and then we type it again by assuming that E prime has the type S2. So we see that with an example. If I want to type this pair, F42, F42, with F, a function from int to bool, I could type it naively and get the type bool times bool. But using the union elimination rule, I can be more precise. What I can do is to decompose the type of F42, which is bool, into the decomposition true or false. So then I substitute in the expression F42 by a new variable x, and I try to type the xx by assuming that first that x is true. And this type is the type true times true. So this is the first case. And now when x is false, I type it again, and I get the type false to false. So like it is a case disjunct. And so in the end, the type of my pair will be the type true times true or false times false, which is more precise than bool times bool, because we know that both components are of the same type. Okay, so we have seen how the union elimination tool works, but actually we have to be careful when we mix it, combine it with polymorphism, because let's try to type again the same example, but this time I choose to decompose the type of F42 into the type bool and alpha, or bool and not alpha, with alpha a polymorphic type variable. So here the issue is that when I will consider each part separately, I will lose the correlation between the two occurrences of alpha. So, for instance, when I treat the first case and I assume that X has the type bool and alpha, I can substitute alpha by empty, which is the hypothesis that X is empty. And of course, it is unfound because it means that I can treat X as if it was a string or an int or anything. And then for the second case, same thing. I have the hypothesis that X has type bool and not alpha, but I can substitute alpha by any, which again yields the hypothesis that X is empty. And so this is unsound. So here's the issue actually is that the decomposition we chose has introduced a polymorphic type variable. So I want to prevent that. So this is one of my contributions, it is to reformulate the union elimination rule. So the new rule is as follows. We first time E prime, which give a type S, which might contain polymorphic type variables. But then the decomposition we do is a decomposition into S and U and S and not U, with U a type that has no polymorphic type variable. And this way, the loop becomes sound. So we just need one last ingredient, is some rules to type cases. Because as we have seen, our language has type cases, and the semantic has type cases as two cases. If the value reduces to value in t, it reduces to e1, otherwise to e2. And so we will just add two very simple rules that capture each case. So the first one, when we know that the expression e already has a type t, then we just type e1. And if we know that e has a type not t, we just type e2. So of course, these two rules alone are not general enough, because maybe when we type, we don't know anything about e, maybe we just know that it has the type any. And in this case, we will not be able to type this type case. But in combination with the union elimination rule, this becomes general enough. Let's see that with an example. So let's say I want to type this function. So it takes a parameter x, it tests whether x is an integer. If it is the case, it returns x plus 1, otherwise it returns false. So here, if I want to type this function, let's say I want to type it for the domain any. So I enter is a lambda, and I assume that x has type any. But then I cannot apply any rule for the type cases. So what I will do instead is to decompose the type of X into the type any and or not any. And I will treat each case separately. So for the first case, by assuming that X has type int, now I can apply the first rule for type case. And something interesting to note is that when I tap the first branch, I do it under the hypothesis that X has type int. So I have performed type narrowing. And then the other case. I assume that X has type not int, and again I can conclude with the second rule for a type case. And so in the end, this is the type any to int or false for this function. So we've seen one possible derivation. Actually, we have another possible derivation for this expression. Instead of using the union elimination rule, we can use the intersection. So for that, what we can do is to, so we have the same expression. And we can choose first to type it, but for the domain int. So we just assume that X has a type int. And in this case, we can directly apply the first rule for type case, and we get the type int to int. And in parallel, independently, we can type it, but for the domain not int. So we assume that X is not an integer, and we can conclude with the second rule for type cases. And now, by combining both derivations, we get this overready type int to int and not int to false, which is strictly more precise than the use type in this case. So as we have two derivations, of course, it means that the system is non-deterministic, is not an algorithm. I don't know which derivation is better, which rule to apply. But before trying to make it algorithmic, I want to state some results I have proved. So I have proved that the type system that I have shown is safe. In the sense that if some expression is typeable with a type t, then we know that this expression either it reduces to a value v of type t or it diverges. So in particular, this means that a well-typed program cannot be stuck. Like in Python, it will be it cannot raise the type error. Okay, but so now the next step is to make the type system algorithmic. So for that, let's see what are the sources of non-determinism in our type system. So a first source of non-determinism is the fact that some rules can be applied on every expression, making the system not syntax directed. So for example, this is the case of the union elimination rule. It can be applied anytime. Also the intersection introduction rule, the instantiation, and the subsumption. And in addition, we have another issue. It's that for some rules, some premises cannot be guessed from the conclusion, which says that the rules are not analytic. This is the case, for instance, of the union elimination rule, because we have to guess a type decomposition, union. And this is the case of the rule for lambda abstraction, because we have to guess the domain. So first, let's try to solve the first issue, that the system is not syntax directed. So what we are going to do, we are first going to get rid of the subsumption or instantiation rule. And for that, we are going to embed these two rules where they are really needed, that is, in the premises of destructor rules. So for instance, one place where I may need to perform an instantiation on the subsumption in when I have an application. I might need to instantiate E1 and or E2. And so I will combine this rule with the instantiation and the subsumption rule, which leads to another rule, more complex for application. No, I don't need anymore the instantiation and subsumption rule, so it becomes syntax directed. At least for both, we get rid of the instantiation and subsumption. But still, we have the union elimination rule that we don't know when to apply. We could apply it anytime. So as we don't want to lose generality, we still want to be able to type as many things as before. We choose to apply the union elimination rule once on every length of expression. And by doing that, we still are general. But how to implement that in the type system? So in order to implement that, we will transform the expression we are typing. Before typing an expression, we will turn it into what we call its maximal Turing canonical form. So basically, it is a form that gives a unique name to each distinct sub-expression. So for the pair f of x, f of x, first, we define the sub-expression f of x, on binding to the variable u, and then we define the pair, so the pair u, on binding to the variable v. So the advantage of doing that is that now I can just apply the union elimination rule on each binding. So it becomes syntax directed because I know when to apply the union elimination rule. It is when I have a binding. So we transform this rule from the declarative type system into this one that only applies on binding. So the rule also becomes syntax directed. Okay. So now let's deal with the other issue. I want to make the rules analytic. So as I said, I have to guess, for instance, I have to guess the domain of function on the decomposition when using the union elimination rule. For this problem, I will cheat a little. What I will do is that my algorithmic type system will take, in addition of the expression to type, it will take an annotation tree that will specify which type decomposition to use when we have a binding and which domain to choose for the lambda abstraction. So this way, the algorithmic type system will take a pair of a maximal Turing canonical form expression and of an annotation tree. And this pair will uniquely encode the derivation. The system becomes deterministic once we have that. So for instance, if I want to type this expression, maximal Turing canonical form, and I have this external annotation, I have only one possibility. As this expression is the binding, I have to apply the union elimination rule, the rule for binding. And which type decomposition to perform is given by the annotation. Here, int, not int. So there is only one possibility. And so this makes the type system algorithmic. So what I have proved is that our algorithmic type system is equivalent to the declarative one, which means that an expression E will be typable with the declarative type system if and only if there exists some external annotation that makes the maximal Turing canonical form of E typable with the algorithmic type system. But naturally, now we have moved the problem, but now the problem is how to infer the external annotation. So we'll try to do that. I will only give the main ideas. But let's try. So one thing I have to infer, I say, is the type decomposition to do when we have a binding. And so for that, I will just look at type cases. So I will go through the expression, and when I encounter a type case, for instance, that tests if Z has a type int, what I will do is to backtrack to the by definition of Z and to split its type into int and not int. And then we also may need to backpropagate the split on the dependencies of Z. So let's see that with an example. If I want to type this type case, so we test whether id of x is an integer, in this case return x, otherwise false, with id the identity function of x of type any. So first, if I want to type that with algorithm type system, I have to turn the expression into its maximal shell form, which is this part. And then I will just type the difference of expression one after the other. So I type x, it gives the type a, any. I type y, it gives the price, the type false, and z, the type any. But now I want to type the type case, but I cannot because I cannot apply the rule for type case because z has type any. So what I will do is I will backtrack to the definition of z, and I will ask to decompose its type into int and not int. And then I will also backpropagate it to its dependencies. So here, for instance, it will propagate this split to the definition of x. So I have backtracked it to the beginning of my expression, and now I can try to type it again. And so this will be this derivation tree. Or this annotation tree. So first for x, I have x, and then I have to consider separately the case where it is an integer. And in this case, I can type y, z, and u, and for u, I will obtain the type int. And I have also to consider the case where x is not an integer, and in this case, u will have the type false. And in the end, the type I will obtain is a union of int or false. So this is for the first thing to infer, the type decomposition. And the second thing to infer was the domain of lambda function, how to guess the domain of a function. And so for that, we will be inspired from algorithm W. We use what we call tiling. So the tiling, so given two types T1 and T2, we want to find all the substitution sigma such that T1 sigma is a subtype of T2 sigma. So it looks like unification, but in unification, we will have instead of the subtyping relation here, we would have an equivalence, a syntactic equivalence. So this tiling is decidable. We know that from prior work, it is not me that did that. And also, another thing to notice that the solution of a tiling instance can be characterized by a principal finite set of substitution, which is a little different from unification because the solution of a unification instance are always can be characterized by at most one principal substitution. Here we might need a set, a finite set, and not just one substitution. And so, as there may be several solutions, we will have to consider each solution in a separate branch. So let's see that with an example. Let's say I want to type the logical R from the introduction. So first, I want to guess the domain of the parameters. So first, I will give a fresh type variable to x, the variable gamma, and to y, delta. And then I will try to type the body. So I encounter the application to boolean of x, and I want this application to be typeable. So for that, I will generate a tiling instance. So we give this tiling instance. And so I'm going to solve this tiling instance in order to know every context, what substitution I have to apply to my context, in order to make this application typeable. And so here, we have two solutions. We have one solution that suggests to substitute gamma by gamma prime and true phi, and another solution that suggests to replace, to substitute gamma by gamma second and phi. And so what I'm going to do is to backtrack to the definition of x, where gamma is introduced, and to treat each case separately. So I will first substitute gamma by gamma prime and true phi, and I will type again the function, and in this case I can die it type successfully and I get the type gamma prime and true phi in the end. And then I type it again, but by adding the other substitution, gamma second and true phi, and in this case the body has a type delta. And so in the end, our type will be the intersection of both paths. So we have an overloaded type, which is equivalent to the type we had in the introduction. Okay. So these are the two ideas of the reconstruction algorithm. Before, until yes, my contribution have been so the conception of a sound and terminating reconstruction algorithm, but it is incomplete. It is incomplete. We don't have a principal type, so we know that it is indecisible. Then I have fully implemented it in OCaml, and you can actually test it online. You don't need to install anything. I have implemented several extensions, pattern matching, records, and regular expression types. So it refines the list type, actually. We'll see that with some example just after. And I have implemented several optimizations. I do some tree pruning in the annotation, some memoization, and type simplification. So let's see a demonstration of this prototype. So for instance, if I have written in the syntax of my prototype, the example from the introduction with the function two boolean and the logical OR. And my type system is able to deduce that two boolean has this type, truly to true and policy to false, and that the logical OR has the type we have with the introduction. And also we can try to apply logical OR to twice the same parameter. And actually doing that is like the identity, and my type system is able to infer the type alpha 12. So until now, I haven't talked about recursive function, but there is a good reason for that is that we have recursive function for free. We don't need the syntax for them. What I can do is to define the fixed point combinator. So this is Curry's fixed point combinator. And my type system is able to infer this type for it. So it is the usual type for the fixed point combinator, except that we have this additional intersection here with gamma, which is a slightly more precise type. I know that I have the fixed point combinator. For instance, I can implement the recursive map function. So first, I implement a map stub function that just takes the map function as parameter and do one step of the iteration. And then I apply the fixed point combinator to it. And my type system is able to infer this type. So in this type, the second branch is the usual one. If we give a function from alpha to beta as first parameter, and if then we give a list of with elements of type alpha, here this is a non-empty list, then we get a list with elements of type beta. But actually, we also infer another branch that says that actually we can give anything as first parameter. If we give an empty list as second parameter, then it returns an empty list. So this branch is not really common. Maybe we don't want it, but it's all right. Another example that I like is a filter example. So we can define the filter function. So I have added a syntax for a recursive function, but it works as we have seen previously. So this filter function takes a predicate f and filters the list l according to this predicate. And if I want to type this function with precision, what I can do is to say that f has the type alpha to any for some alpha and beta to false c. And so it tells me that all elements that are in the type beta will be converted to false c with a predicate. And now if I say that the list I give as input as the type alpha or beta, as the list of elements of type alpha or beta, my prototype is able to infer that this function returns the list with elements are of type alpha minus beta. And this is very useful because now, for instance, if I have a list that may contain some elements, some integers, but also a value null and an empty string that I want to get rid of, I can call filter of two boolean of this list, and my type system is able to infer that the resulting list will only have integers, and actually, even it will only have 4, 47, and 42 as elements. And then I can apply, for instance, the successor function on this list, and it types correctly. And this thing is quite idiomatic. Filtering a list, I think, is quite idiomatic, so it is interesting, I think, to be able to do that. Okay, so in conclusion, so my goal was to statically type dynamic languages without hindering their flexibility. For them, a contribution have been to define the decorative type system that mixes union type, intersection type, and polymorphism. And then to define an averaging type system that is equivalent but that require annotations. And the last step is to define an algorithm to reconstruct this annotation. Algorithm that is not complete, but the programmer may help the inference with annotations. And they have fully implemented this prototype. This has led to three publications. One in the journal Science of Computer Programming, and two at Popple, where I have presented my work twice. Okay. And last, I will end with some future work. So currently, which features do we support? We support overlapping function and dynamic dispatch on type cases. Also, we support generics, and we have structured subtyping for pairs and defaults. But if you want to apply it to the work language, there are some missing features that prevent some future work. So for instance, we may need nominal subtyping if you want to type abstract data types or objects with inheritance, for instance. We may also need, so here I work with pure lambda calculus, but if we have side effects, we need to restrict the use of the union deviation rule in order for it to be sound. And so actually this thing is currently studied by another PhD student. So, also, I may want to add graduate typing if I want to. So, graduate typing allows untyped and typed code to interact. And so, this is a very good thing if you want to add the type system to an already existing language. And actually, can also allow to be more flexible. For instance, if you want to allow the user to use the eval function that we find sometimes in dynamic languages. Oh, we cannot type the eval function in the general case. And so maybe using other typing may help us allowing this construct. And we will lose some guarantees, of course, but it's okay. And also, we may need some language-specific filters. For instance, another PhD student is currently trying to add set theoretic types to Elixir. And for instance, in Elixir, we have pattern guards. So we have pattern matching and pattern that is guarded by condition. And so we have to add this feature.
Thank you for your attention. Thank you very much. So now we're going to ask your questions. I want to check that Amal is still there.
No, not.
Can you hear us, Amal?
Yes.
Okay, so we're going to start with reviewers and we'll come back to the examiners later. So let's start with Jan Bitte.
Okay. Thank you for the presentation. I'll start with your slide minus one. You
can go. Yes.
So you were telling us that you can. No, that's great.
I minus one, okay, from the IS.
Sorry, well, you don't have a slide.
Yes.
Yes,
so you said that the goal was to statically type dynamic languages without hindering their flexibility. So what evidence do you have that you have not hindered their flexibility?
I will hinder that flexibility, I think. So actually, I should rephrase it by saying with hindering the flexibility the less I can. I think I have to find a sweet spot between what guarantees typing will give me and what I will allow the user, what flexibility the user will have. So for instance, I gave the example of the eval function. So of course, this function eval cannot be typed in a systematic way. But in this case, maybe if we still want the user sometimes to apply it, maybe we could use Gradle typing. So I have not studied it. So here we have a compromise. By using Gradle typing in this place, we lose some guarantees, but we give more flexibility to the user. So this will be a sweet spot. Thank you.
But so I'm still not sure what can you sort of characterize. Things you cannot do that are done commonly in the languages you're interested. Like not the features you're not treating, but within the set of features you looked at, what is not possible? You're cutting out some parts of the programs that people can write, so. Or
yes. So first, as our recursion algorithm is not complete, sometimes the user will have to annotate if he wants the program to be typed. So
can
first,
you always annotate?
No. So for instance, in my demonstrations, the only thing I have annotated is the argument of the filter function. Because if I don't put this annotation, it will infer a type that is less precise. That is true, but less precise. It will be like an examiner type in the view. So here in this case, I have to annotate. For any other function here, I don't need type annotations. So yes, annotations will be needed sometimes.
Is it the contention, sorry to jump in, is it the contention that that fits the set of feature you're supporting can be annotated and type checked?
I don't think so. I don't think so because, I mean, it's not a very pragmatic example, but you could have a function in the dynamic language, you could have a function that with an unreachable part. But that does not type as that is a 42 applied to 42, and I will not always be able to with the type system to see that this is unreachable because it might depend on some arithmetic. No, I will not be able to type everything.
So back to my original question, how much of the natural programming style do you think you're hindering by adding types?
So I was focused on the overloaded aspect, on the type case aspect. I haven't really thought about other aspects of dynamic languages. I mean, on the example that I've tried, it always worked with annotation, but I haven't, maybe I'm missing some examples. Actually, I don't really know. But we are more expressive than TypeScript, or for instance, we said maybe MyPy. Actually, MyPy, I don't really know precisely how it infers things. But our type algebra is more powerful than the one of TypeScript. Mm-hmm. Maybe we have some featureless, but with the intersection, it's more powerful. I mean, if we can type JavaScript with TypeScript, I think we could type Python or even JavaScript with my type system.
Okay. Should I keep going or somebody else? Or what's the process?
You can ask more now, or you can ask more later if you want.
I'll pass the hand.
So we move to Alan.
Okay, so I jump on this annotation convention. Just to clarify, so you say that you cannot infer annotations for every dynamic code, but what about well typed code, meaning that
Well type for my declarative type system?
If you can type it in the declarative type system, mm-hmm. can you always add annotations?
Yes, that's a very good question. I have some paragraph in my thesis, the conclusion about that. So I think yes, it may not be the case currently in the prototype, but we can tend to that. Actually, there are two main things that the reconstruction is inferring, so it is the domain of functions. So if we allow the user to annotate the parameters of function, it may solve this issue. And there are also the decomposition to do. So my reconstruction only do a decomposition going by with the type case currently. But actually, we might want to do a union elimination even when there are no type cases for having a bitter type. And in this case, it will not be done. But I have added into my prototype kind of annotations to say to manually do type decomposition. But actually, those annotations are maybe not very intuitive for the programmer that will do Python. So I don't know if realistically we can say that he will be able to do it. But I think by using enough annotation, yes, we can. We are complete with respect to the declarative type system.
Okay, And so the big question is how easy, so I will phrase. Is it okay that the type inference may fail?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have any annotation,
yes.
For instance.
Oh, yes.
And if your system is complete, there are some annotations that can make it succeed for
yeah.
a white type curve.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how difficult is it to find them for the programmer? Because it's a programmer who has to
yes.
provide them.
Well, for the question of the parameter of function, I think it is easy. I mean, programmers do that in TypeScript, so it's not very different. I don't know. I it depends how precise also we want the function to be. For instance, for the map function, I've said that the type inferred automatically has two branches. Maybe we don't want this one because it makes everything more complicated. So even when it type checks, the user might want to put an annotation to say just keep this branch and don't focus on the other case. But I think for the like for other type system, it would be easy. And about our type system is that unrestricted intersection union, there is no restriction. Sometimes some language are restricted by the type algebra, but it is not our case, and I think it makes it easier for the programmer to make what he wants to do it for. So this is the aspect for the domain of lambda function. And for the type decomposition, I don't think, I mean, in practice, on what I have tested, we don't, except an example that I have specifically made for that, it is not an issue. We never need to impose a type decomposition. But maybe in some case that I have not in mind, we might need it. And for that, we can automate detection, but I think it would be hard for the programmer to know that he has to do that. It's not intuitive.
Okay, and just to continue on that, what is the largest example you've
tested? Yes, so I have not on the slide. It was from the OCaml map library. It is a balance function that balances the tree we build. So it type checks well, but it takes some time because so as we have seen, the reconstruction algorithm is freely branching. It branches for the domains of function. When we have overloaded function, it will do backtracking and pretype several times. And so it branches because of type decomposition. And so on large examples that make a lot of type cases, for instance, the type decomposition thing will maybe explode. So the performance will be an issue. But I have ideas to make it better by isolating some putting bounds to where it can backtrack. So we will lose some expressivity, but maybe we have to find some sweet spot at some point.
Okay. I have many more questions, but maybe you can too. So
back to me. Yes.
Sure.
Right. So that's good. So remind me, is subtyping decidable?
Yes, it is.
But there are still more features you want to add, I guess.
Yes.
So things like bounded polymorphism.
I haven't. So we have bounded polymorphism. At least we have a problem because we have intersection. And so, for instance, if I want to express, for instance, for all alpha smaller than int, for instance, alpha to alpha, I can just write instead alpha and int, alpha intersected with integer to alpha intersected with integer. And so this is the form of bounded polymorphism. And for the other direction, I will have a union. So we have bounded polymorphism actually.
Object types or
So I have these records. I have records, but I don't have homomorphism for records. And this has been studied by another student. But then we have to implement it. It's some work.
So I guess where I'm going is once you add all those features, do you still think you're staying within the decidable and side of things?
So for the inference, we already are not decidable. But I think we can still have a declarative type system, another declarative one that is complete, because everything that we may need can be given by annotation. So maybe we will have more complex annotation. For the subtyping, I think nominal subtyping is not an issue. We have to formalize it, but I really think we can have decidable subtyping. I think it's not so hard. So yeah, if we, for, when we add a side effect, you have a new problem to detect what function can have side effects, and this leads to a new undecidable thing. So we have to make some approximation here. When we have to detect what is what are side effects.
Okay. So I guess where I wanted to get to is the comparison between what you're doing and the TypeScript type system, which is, as far as I know, unsound. So there seems like you have something that could be a better basis for building, but I don't understand exactly the trade-offs. Can you tell us something about, you know, what you're building here and how does it compare to TypeScript?
So we are and for type cases, for instance, we so our type basically our type are more powerful, even though we may need some feature, but overall it's more powerful. But the drawback of our brush is performance. And so if we want something as fast as type 3, we'll have to find some compromises. Because for instance, I know that type 3 at some point, if it has to decide a subtyping instance that is too long, that has too many terms, at some point it just says, oh, okay, it's okay, it's just a type, I don't care. And so this is unsound, of course, but it is pragmatic in the sense that it is a very constant performances. I don't want if we want to do that at some point. I don't know. But if we want the same performance as TypeScript, we will have to do things like that, I think.
So, and what is your target language, if I may ask?
None. I mean, that's why I have put several languages, Python, JavaScript. I have more studied Python and JavaScript. I would say Python because Philippe, that is working on adding side effects, is working on Python, so we already have some translation. Okay. So maybe Python is a good candidate.
So if this is the candidate, what is your view on integrating this work in that language? Not necessarily you, but somebody. How would one go and take what you've done? Or is that the idea to take what you've done and put it in Python?
Yes.
So how would you see that happen?
I mean, we should ask Guillaume because he's doing that for Elixir.
Yeah, but you're on the spot, so we'll
ask you. Thank you. So yes, the idea would be to adapt it to a bigger language. I don't think we can do it right now because we still have the mutability thing to settle. But once we have that, I think really most of the work will be efficiency, will be optimization. I really think the prototype can be, it is very simple actually, the prototype, if you look at the source code, it is very simple. I really think the hard part is first maybe to re-implement all the self-theoretic algebra because it is coded in OCaml, but maybe if you want to...
Details,
okay.
Concepts.
But then I think the hard part really would be to have something optimized. I really think it is the hard thing. And for that, it will not be easy.
Okay. Good.
Okay. So maybe we'll switch to Amal with the remote.
Hi. Yes. So some of the questions have already been touched upon. So let me sort of, you know, in terms of what sorts of annotations do you need? How does the programmer know where to add them? So let me sort of try to switch to how would one, you know, if you really want to bring this to a language like Python or JavaScript, the issue of mutable state, how would you handle mutable state? Do you have ideas for that?
So for mutable state, so we could have two different approach. Either we do a first analysis that is independent from typing and that detects which function have side effects. And then once we have this information, one thing we can do is to disallow the linear elimination rule to be called an expression that have side effects, or alternatively for the algorithmic case system, it will be to not factorize some expression that have side effects into just one definition. So yeah, the first idea is to do a first analysis to detect side effects, and this is what Philippe is doing. And also, we might think of adding effects to our types. So annotating, we will have like a list of effects on the top of the arrow, for instance. But this seems more complex, and we'll have to like to extend the set theoretic types theory. So it is more work, and so I think it is more far away. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess the question is, what are all of the technical aspects of the system that this will touch, right?
Yes. So for the algorithmic point of view, it will just be when we put the expression into the maximal Turing canonical form. I have not decided to release the maximal Turing canonical form, but one thing that it does is that if there are two occurrences of the same expression, there will be a bound to the same variable. It will become just one definition. But this is not sound to do that when we have side effects. And so we have to, if we have side effects, we have to do two independent definition and not factorize the two occurrences. And this is the only thing that will change from an algorithmic point of view, but we have to detect side effects for that, to detect which function have side effects.
Maybe we'll let Amal continue with questions.
No, go ahead.
Just wanted to say, and what if the answer is all functions have side effects, which would be probably not.
Okay, so in this case, what if we mean that in the maximal Turing canonical form, every occurrence will be one definition independent? This does not. So if we do that, we have no more occurrence typing. But what we can do is that only almost for variables, when we just have a variable, we know that variable will not have side effects. So for variables, we can still factorize them. And it still allows to do some type narrowing. For instance, it would be enough type narrowing to type the filter function. So to type the filter function to deduce this type in the end, we have to perform.
You have to use the pointer, otherwise,
yes.
Amal.
Where I have to put the pointer. Okay. Oh, wait. Okay. Here. So on the filter function, we have to perform type narrowing to deduce that in the case, in the then case, f of e, in particular e, is not of type beta, is of type not beta. So this is type narrowing. So if every expression may have side effect, if we say that every application, for instance, has side effect, still we will be able to make this deduction because here e is a variable. So we will still be able to deduce things about e. But for instance, if we add an occurrence of f of e here, we will not be able to deduce anything about f of e. So it will be not dramatic. It will be not very precise, but maybe it's okay. But we want to be more precise, and that's the work of Philippe.
Okay, so let's go back to Amal. Do you have other questions to ask?
I'm good for now. I'll save them for later.
Okay. So it's fine for now, right? So we move to Delia.
Okay, thank you. So first of all, thanks for your presentation and for your manuscript that I found very, very well written and very clear. So my first question is about your parallel reductions operational semantics. I was surprised to find such an operational semantics justified by the type system. And so, if I understood well your definition of the parallel reduction semantics, needs to check the equality of terms, which is usually quite costly.
Yes.
And so my question, so I have two questions about that. First of all, if you have some, if you have thought about the cost of this operation, because it is, I like the two questions, and then I give you a draw. And so this is the first one, and the second one is if it is possible to maybe move to a more standard notion of parallel reduction. So I understand the need of a parallel reduction operation and semantics, but maybe if you can move to a more natural and standard definition of parallel reduction when you don't need to search for it.
But yes, so actually I depends on the definition of terms, but in my case, it only checks syntactic equality modulo alpha arbitrary, which is decidable. And actually, it needs to match the behavior of the union elimination rule. So the union elimination rule, to in order to, it can decompose the type of different occurrences if these occurrences are syntactically equivalent. So I need the same behavior for the parallel reduction. I need it to do the step on all sub-expressions that are syntactically equivalent. But I don't think it is an issue because syntactic equivalence is easy. And so you said more standard, what are the more standard definition
of? A one in which you don't necessarily reduce only the E expression that you want to share, but you produce eventually more expressions that you don't need to check for equality of terms.
But how can we, if we cannot check if two terms are syntactically equivalent, how can we allow?
Can you reduce, for example, a very naive one would be to reduce all the radices in parallel.
Ah, okay.
You will do more than necessary, but you will not check for equality.
In any case, I only took what I really need to have subject reduction, and the minimum I need is when I perform a reduction to apply the same reduction on every occurrence. Yeah. It is the minimum that I need. Maybe I can do more, but I'm not sure it will make the proof easier, actually. I just use what I need. I have not.
So you are not concerned about the cost of the quality of
terms. It is only for the proof. This five semantic thing. It is only to prove the type safety, the subject reduction, and then the type safety. So no, there is no really performance consideration. And for the union elimination rule that also checks the syntactic equality, we can see with our prototype that it costs absolutely nothing. It is nothing compared to the type system itself. So,
okay.
Not an issue.
So I have another question is related to the kind of idempotent types that you are using, which are idempotent ones.
Yes.
Even if we forget the union types for a moment, so I understood that is a crucial thing in your work. But even if you forget about unions for a while, so usually idempotent types allows to capture some kind of properties of your programs when they are complete. Here you are not complete in the sense that, I mean, you can type delta delta. So typing implies some property, but you cannot capture, for example, termination with your typing because
I cannot ensure termination. No, I cannot ensure termination. Actually, we can type the fixed point combinator as I shown, and so we can type the differential.
Okay. But in any case, if you move from the idempotent to non-idempotent in this framework, do you think that it could be used to get some quantitative information from your programs, which is what is usually done with non-idempotent types, non-idempotent intersection types, is that you use this non-idempotency to get some quantitative information. It would be possible to do that in this framework.
Okay, so that's a hard question. Actually, yeah, because it changes a lot of things. Because self-heuristic types are, by essence, idempotent. And when I design the type system, I always in mind, I reason about semantic equivalence all the time. So Yeah, it's hard to imagine right now what it would imply if we don't use if we have a non-independent type system.
Usually, it can be used to measure the number of uses of some resource. For example, different occurrences of the same variable will have probably the same type, but you will not join them with an idempotent rule.
Yes. Another thing I'm really relying on is the tallying, so the final solution or the substitution so that term becomes a subtype of another. And I don't think if we have such tool in with other potent types, as, do we have can we have like the unification, the tallying? Because in, what's cool with set-theoretic types is that we have the tallying, and it allows me to infer everything. Yes, this thing, and it is possible because set-theoretic types are recursive or very powerful. This is why we can we have this wonderful tool. I don't know in if we have again non-idempotent types. Actually, I think it will really change a lot of things. So it's hard for me to answer the question.
Just a respective question. And the last one is, so here you talk about typing. So you have your title, you don't have your annotations, but then you, the idea is you start from the types, from the term, sorry, and you look for the types. If you do the dual thing, so you have the types and you look for the terms, so program synthesis. Have you thought about that? It would be learning in this framework. It is easy.
Not at all. Actually, we're interested in this because we want to synthesize program, maybe to train AI to infer types more quickly than I do. So program synthesis will be interesting, but I haven't studied it. So yeah, actually, I don't have any idea in mind right now.
Okay.
Thank you, Delia. So we move to the advisors. And later, I will again ask if anyone wants to ask more questions. So, Bibi?
Oh, I have really no question about that. I just can say how nice it was to be working really with Mikhail. Because the person who knows them, this may sound surprising, but he is very organized and goal oriented and enthusiast. Which is not really in the everyday life, but in the work, it's very good student, excellent, with nice ideas, passionate, coming with the new ideas. All I can say is that I was lucky to have such a student. That's all I can say.
So I have lots of questions and I will ask none of them. We have already talked a lot. I will just join Bébé. So of course you are a very brilliant student, but what struck me the most is your enthusiasm with respect to this particular topic. I don't know if it was a good match or if you liked it particularly, but whenever there was difficulty, you just poke and search stuff and came up with a solution that no one thought about, and you said, oh, I tried 20 things and none of them worked, and I found another one and it worked. So, and you went forward with that. And
you're talking about when I find an issue in my proofs,
or a bug in my code, and the bug is still there, but you worked around that. So, that's great. And no, I have nothing to say but praises about your work and your attitude toward the research.
Thank you.
Yeah. I have a few questions myself, but I first let Alan, if you want to ask one more questions before.
Sure, I can ask a very general question, which kind of related to what Kim just said. The beginning of your manuscript, you mentioned that this is the last attempt at solving the issue, and there were several attempts before that. Can you say a few words about them? What went wrong or
what yes.
right?
So the very first attempt was refocused on the type narrowing thing. So deducing type information about variables when you are in the branch of a type case. And I have a very different approach. So here, what I do is I introduce to a maximal Turing canonical form that give a names to each sub-expression. And then I can just assume that for instance the variable z has the type int, for instance. And that means that id of x has the type int. In a previous approach, what I did is that I had not this form, and so I wanted to be able to keep type information about expression, about application, for instance. And so I will allow putting in my environment something like id of x. Like my environment will go from expression to type, and not only variable to type. But actually, it was, I think, a mistake. It's way better this way because it adds a lot of things like edge cases and things like that. So this was the first approach. And then I had this idea with my supervisor. We had this, we have this idea of using a maximal Turing canonical form on the union animation rule. And so we did a first attempt of this type system, but at this time we did not add type variables on polymorphism. And actually, also this was a bad idea, I mean it was the first step, but actually adding type variables, like I did in this talk, allows to simplify many things, in particular the reconstruction, the inference of annotations. And so yes, the second approach adds the bindings, but no type variables, and so it was less beautiful.
I disagree. I disagree. It was beautiful, at least for the union elimination, the connection.
Yes, 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 yes. Type case. Yes. No, it was the reconstruction that was ugly. But yeah. The type system was ugly. The reconstruction was ugly. Yes.
And did you record these attempts?
Yes, because so the very first one with environment that goes from the expression to that, it's on the journal, the Science of Programming. Okay, yes. So this is the very first attempt, then the one without polymorphism and with union animation rule, and the one of this test. So each attempt has been published.
So your 200 pages is the last paper.
Yes, exactly. Pages. But I have need some extra extra information.
So I ask, I have a few questions which will be quick. It's all of them. First, I want to thank you for the presentation and also all the work that you didn't have time to mention. And enjoy reading the manuscript, and there is an amazing amount of work there. So my first question will be: so actually, you did a lot of work to show that you have a specification which is kind of standard. But then you had an algorithmic presentation and you spend a lot of energy in a manuscript to show that you have equivalence between these two systems. But actually you have three systems. So you have a specific declarative, what you call the algorithmic system, and then the type inference.
Yes.
So the specification is nice, but then the algorithm which is doing type inference, we don't really know what it does because it's incomplete. So would there be a way to have another specification that would be weaker, but would characterize what type inference does?
By specification, you mean you would constrain the expression or the type system, or?
Well, a kind of either declarative or more algorithmic, but not in a way. So when you run type inference, it gives you an answer, and you don't know if it doesn't work. You don't know whether it's untypeable or you should have put more annotations. So you don't really know why it doesn't work, mm-hmm. because you don't have it's an algorithm, but you don't know what it does because it's incomplete in the perspective spec. So one way maybe would be to change the spec to make it weaker, to disallow inferring types that the type inference cannot infer. So would there be a way to try to weaken the type system so that then you understand what type inference does?
Yes, I see, but this would make the type system, I think what's going to be difficult is that the algorithmic type system that I have is really simple. It's really just a natural deduction with some typing, but if we wanted to exactly characterize with the declarative type system what we're able to infer, I think it would be a complex type system. For example, one of the sources of incompleteness is the expansion when we have, for instance,
Mark cannot see.
Okay. So, for instance, yes. When you have an application, we apply a function to an argument. maybe we have to instantiate the function, but in two different ways with an intersection. We have, for instance, the identity. Maybe we want to instantiate int to int and bool to bool to make it typeable with what comes next. But the identity initially is that just the type alpha to alpha. So if you do just one instantiation, it is just int to int or just bool to bool, but not the intersection of the two. We are able using tallying to infer what instantiation I have to perform on the identity in order for it to be typeable, but not by expanding it into an intersection of several things. I don't know if I am clear. It is not decidable.
I think the answer it would not be easy. So you don't have principal type, this is not your fault. That's just, we know, but once you don't have the principal type, then it's getting into trouble. However, I thought that when you have intersection types, maybe you could have principal type. The only system that could have principal types would be ML and intersection type. Does it have you? Do you know why you don't have principal type?
Oh, I have an example, for instance.
In the decorative system, not in the type inference.
Yes, yes, but for instance, but, I mean the Verdi type system is equivalent to the algorithmic one in terms of expressivity. So, for instance, for the BISMAC function, actually, I could add some more branches to it. For instance, I could say that so the first parameter is still alpha to beta. But then, like I said, that if I give as input a list of two elements, I have a regex, so I can express that. If I have here a list of two elements, I can return a list of two elements. And I can add more branch like that. If I have a list of three elements, I get a list of three elements, etc. And so we will need infinite intersection to have the...
Okay. So in some cases, you may still have principal type. Do you know when this happens? Could you tell the user, oh, this type in principle, don't worry.
Well,
if you type the identity function, you have principal type.
Oh, sorry,
if you type the identity function, and you give principal type to identity.
Yes, in this case, because we have polymorphism.
So maybe that case is where you type. Maybe there are cases when you have principal types.
Yes. Sometimes. So you're suggesting characterizing when it, we have principal types
subset
or
of cases
subset? Yes. Okay. So I think we may have issue when we have recursive function. So this pattern with the map function that we can add intersection is because it is recursive. So what could we do? What would be a subset with? Actually, I think it's hard to characterize when this when we would have principal types. I mean, if we have no pattern matching at all, if we have no type case, no overloaded behavior, we will have principal types. I think if we have no overloaded behavior,
I'm not sure. But something like linear terms, to identities one or composition function, maybe ones, maybe it will be attractive. So I want to move to another topic. So you insist in the here in the talk and in the manuscript that you want to do type checking, modular type checking. So you want, and this is why you introduce polymorphism, but you can type check one definition, and then it's fine, and then you move to the other one. However, you don't quite have that since you don't have principal types, because you type check 10 definitions, and then the last one doesn't type check. And maybe now, it's just because the first definition, this was not principal enough. So you need to go back and put an annotation to get a more precise type. Did you think about that and how to solve that?
I think we really want to be compositional. So we really don't want to retype what has already been typed because it is a big library. We don't want to retype it. So I think at some point the user will have to annotate and for instance, for the map function, as I said, this is the type inference. Maybe, so it is the other direction, but maybe we want to make the type simpler. And so just to say that F has this type, and so we only have one branch. On the opposite, if, for instance, for some function, the user thinks the type inference is not enough for what it will do after, the user will have to annotate it to have a overloaded type. I don't see any other solution, to be honest, because we really want to be compositional.
Okay, I didn't intend to ask, but since you're insisting on this type that is too rich. So actually, you infer in very rich types, and in, both in the manuscript and some examples, and here in the talk, you say, oh, maybe you want to hide that. These are too details. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't like to see them. So it's kind of, I don't know, strange to spend so much time inferring those, and then in most cases, they're not so useful.
But not so, it depends. So this point, I think it's not useful. But for instance, it is very useful to have this preference type for Peter because it allows this kind of thing, filtering something that may contain nil. This is done a lot in dynamic languages where lists can have several types, any types of objects inside. So for Peter, it is useful to have a preference type. I think for the logical order of JavaScript also, it is useful because people use a lot the union in JavaScript. For instance, they can write some variable or zero, some variable or 42. For instance, for an optional parameter, they just take a parameter x, but it might be null. And they can just write x double pipe 42 to say it is either x if it is not null or 42. It's like an encoding of optional parameter. And if you want to be able to type that precisely, we need the precise type for the logical or, and so the precise type for two Boolean. So I think it is useful.
This one, another one, the manuscript with the flattening is still the one before.
The
numbers at the end, it's.
Yes.
At the end.
Yes.
It looks like you just need the computation. This one, not quite, but there is another one you show with flatten when the type tells you exactly the list you get at the end. So we understand why it's one in the manuscript, but never mind. It's true that type checking somehow. In some cases, when you want to go all through cases, it's like evaluating the program. Do you think this, there is something like that happening?
I don't think. So here we see the constants for 47, 42, because yeah, the list directly had constants in it. But. What is the question exactly? If I
it's known in some version of intersection types that type checking amounts to evaluation. They could be put in correspondence. It was done by Joel. So you don't have exactly that system, but there should be something like that happening in your system as well.
Yes, I mean the types can sometimes tell too much thing on the implementation about the implementation can share implementation detail by having a precise type. So maybe sometimes you have to find a sweet spot. For instance, it is not related to evolution. I don't think.
Never mind. It was just a side question. A quick one. So you mean the beginning in the introduction, you insist on the key thing in your work is occurrence typing because you want to understand dynamic languages. And this reminds me of what GLDD does in Camel. When you enter a pattern matrix GLDDs, then in each branch you get a more precise types than outside. So it's similar to occurrence typing. Think about this parallel. Could you say something about it?
I haven't thought about it. That's a good parallel, but I haven't thought about it. I don't know if I would be able to say something interesting about it. I have a thing about it, maybe we'll discuss it.
And the last question would be just to give you, so you spend a whole chapter on discussing efficiency in your manuscript. You don't have time to do that here. So I'd want to give you an opportunity to say a few words on efficiency and how you would improve your situation.
Okay. Efficiency is an issue with the first thing that may cause efficiency issue is when you have a function that does a lot of type cases, invocative type cases, because we have a lot of union elimination. would be your real branching. This is the first case. And the other case is when we have a function that is overloaded, like a recursive function with a lot of functional parameters, because actually this will be a lot overloaded, and by trying to find all the cases, the reconstruction will explore many, many branches. So for the first case, when we have a function of implicated type cases, my type system, the balance function from the OCaml library, it types it, I think, in like 2 seconds, I think something like that. So it is a lot
much. So actually, the timings you give are amazing. I was impressed.
Okay.
It's just because the computers have really changed over 23 years. I remember the first version of CAML, there was one file when it was touch checking the touch checker, but it would take 10 minutes to touch check.
Yeah, but there are a lot. I mean, it's just the balance function that takes 2 seconds. I think it is a lot.
So the question is whether, so it looks fast, but at the same time, we cannot see, or it suggests that in some cases we should blow up.
Yes.
So any idea? So it's really exponential and
the most essential.
How would you tame it? Because if
it's really exponential. And if you write a recursive function with several functional parameters, it will never terminate in practice. It will really.
So then what can we do with that?
We have to annotate this parameter. I don't have any. We might think of some heuristic that will prune some branches. I already prune some redundant branches when I am trying to find overloaded behaviors. But we might also have a heuristic to prune even a branch, even when it is not redundant, if we think that it is not interesting. And by doing that, we might improve it. But I think in the end, we also need a user annotation for this kind of function. Not on all parameters, but maybe on some of them in order to reduce the search phase.
Okay, thank you. I want to go back to Amal if you want to ask other questions.
Yeah, I did want to go back to one issue. So in chapter 10, you sort of talk about how certain things would require type annotations. But you also say something about programmers achieving the right balance between precision and simplicity. So I'm sort of hung up on that. Like, how is there something that one could do to guide a programmer, perhaps using error messages, perhaps giving some sort of feedback to guide them towards that?
Yes, so that's a good question. Actually, error messages is not the first of my prototype. It's not the so my prototype right now just say annotation inference failed and just try again. So but yes, I think we could add feedback to the user. I think of the type inference as an interactive process, like the IDE would suggest the domain for the parameters of the function, and then the user can choose one domain or several domains. So yeah, maybe something interactive would be possible. But the issue,
I mean, there are multiple things at play here. There's one is that type inference might actually fail, and adding annotations in certain places can help. But then, as you're adding annotations, how precise do you really want it to be, right? Like the precision versus simplicity thing. So all of them kind of put together, like, where do I even want to add the annotations in order to get more completeness in a sense, right?
So what was the question?
This goes back to something that was discussed before, like, how does a programmer know where they should be adding annotations?
I think we should always... that's why I was talking about an interactive process. I think we should always mm-hmm. ask the user to annotate mm-hmm. the parameter of function to have something okay. homogeneous. So it allows to retype faster after. But then mm-hmm. it would be an interactive process, and the IDE suggests a type, and the user can select one. And if it takes too long to enter any type, the user will just write it itself, himself. So. I think yeah. it should be systematic. Okay. We should ask the users to write annotation, but the inference will give him some hints. So yeah, I think for time annotation, that it should always put them but with the help of the inference. And for the annotation,
so is this a research problem? Like, is this a big research problem, or is this a, you know, tiny bit of figuring out as to how to give them the hints?
I think this thing is not a big research problem, but the big research problem is maybe to have a good error messages and to also to have a good pretty printing of such phoretic types. Because sometimes printing a such phoretic types can, I think, Python user are not ready for that. So we have some work to do there.
All right, thanks.
Are you done, Amar?
Yes.
Is there anyone who wants to ask another question? Someone in the room would like to ask a question? Okay, so thank you very much. Jury is going to meet.
Another room.
So can you tell Amar what to do?
Yeah, so Amar, I